York Avenue Northwest in Washington, D.C. Speakers include Mark Morial, Dr. Julianne Malvo, Melanie Campbell, Reverend Sharon Arlene Bradley, Hillary Shelton, Dr. George Frazier, Mel Foote, Maurice Mitchell, and Dr. Melina Abdullah. For further information, visit the website ibw21.org. That's ibw21.org.
Peace, this is Atan Thomas, and you're listening to WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice.
I got so much trouble on my mind. Refuse to lose. Here's your ticket.
He is amazing.
I didn't know nothing about it.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Say what you say, say what?
I don't want to be like Mike.
Before Magic's knees go permanently south for the winter.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Changing up the guard quicker than fear brings down doo-doo.
With the finger roll, plus the foul.
Hey, young bro.
He never saw Elgin Baylor play during his day or Oscar Robertson.
Flash the dice roll back. The big O was jackknifing through all them bodies.
I didn't know nothing about it.
Welcome to the collision. This is the part where I say he's Atan Thomas, he's Chuck Modiano, I'm Dave Zirin, here for your home of Jazz and Justice, 89.3 FM, WPFW, trying to change this world one broadcast at a time. We don't have Atan Thomas with us this week, but we do have Chuck Modiano emerging from the lair, the lab, where he's doing all kinds of experiments to try to make a better world, the scientist of struggle, Chuck Modiano. How you doing, Chuck?
Well, after that intro of the scientist of struggle, I'm doing great, a lot better than a minute ago.
I'm telling you, man, we got to now start in this new 2024 Trump restoration, revanchist restoration. We got to start just taking our cues and making everything like pro wrestling, because clearly that's what the electorate wants. But that's a joke and half, because I think what the electorate actually wants is some positive reform here, which I don't think either party is so fond on giving up, but especially the Democrats, as we're going to discuss. But let me tell everybody, Chuck, what we're going to be talking about this week.
Let's go.
We'll make it plain. First and foremost, I think, you know, it's time for us to speak about the elections a little bit through the lens of sports. But what we're going to talk about first, as a lead-in to speaking about some election hoo-ha, is to talk about the double standard that recently took place in the National Football League, where one player got the lightest possible slap on the wrist for making an incendiary political claim. And then another player you might remember from almost a decade ago received a much different fate for, frankly, a much more important issue. And I think if you look at why one player had one fate and another player had another fate, I think it gives some valid insight into 2024 and what took place. Chuck, should I just jump in with this?
You should, but I'm still reeling about, you said almost a decade ago, and that's blowing my mind, but continue.
No, and as we say almost a decade ago, it's very important to remember that, Chuck, because for you and me, at our age, it's like, okay, that was a decade ago. What's going on in 2024? You know, like, we're seeing things big picture. But if you're 20 years old in 2016, you're 28 now with a whole different set of life concerns. If you're 10 years old in 2016, or how about this? If you're 8 years old in 2016, like my son was, because I had a long talk with my son about the elections last night. It was fascinating. For him, Trump, like, remember us in 2016, Trump was a lunatic, a reality TV host, this unbelievable, everybody's in panic mode. For my son, Trump is just another weird old right winger who's always been a part of his political consciousness.
So he's been normalized.
Yes. Now, they're good and bad in that, though, Chuck, as I think. Bad because this horror show has been normalized, and I think a lot of us never wanted some right-wing proto-fascist to get normalized. But on the other side, we can finally dispense with the fiction, because young people certainly have, that Trump is somehow represents something new, some kind of third way. Like, for people like my son, oh, another crazy right-winger in a country full of them. Yeah, this guy does some kooky things from the stage. But another racist, another bigot, another person selling false promises. Now, granted, some of that may come from growing up in our house. I admit that.
Are you saying you have influence on your own children, too?
Just a little, not nearly as much as you think. But I just found, this was something we just sort of discovered last night, because I heard it talked about on a podcast, when I very much recommend Kianga Yamada Taylor talking to Dan Denver on The Dig about the recent elections, Dr. Kianga Yamada Taylor. And I tried to test it, because she made that point on the pod that, you know, for a generation of young people, this is what political life is like.
Right.
And
right.
That's important for us to remember as we start to develop our own strategies. That's my point. But let me tell this NFL story, Chuck, and I'll get your response, because then, you know, it flows into so much to me about the problem with the electoral system in this country and why we find ourselves in this horrible situation. So I'm just going to launch into this, Chuck, and I realize
launch.
I'm filibustering and talking too much.
Filibuster, launch away, blast off.
All right, I want to hear what you have to say here about this, buddy. So, on October 27th, you know, mere days before the presidential election, Brock Purdy, the quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers, is being interviewed after a primetime Sunday night victory against the Dallas Cowboys. And for those who don't know, and Chuck, I don't know if you know this, Sunday Night Football has been the number one show in America, like, seasonally, highest ratings for entire TV season, for like 15 years.
So to
call Sunday Night Football, or as it's called, Football Night in America, the most watched and arguably the most culturally important television program in terms of mass culture, in terms of mass sentiment in this country, you know, that's Football Night in America. And our listeners may not realize that, but that's what it is. So after the game, Brock Purdy is being interviewed on the sideline. The game had just ended, tens of millions of people watching. And their defensive end and the reigning defensive player of the year, so not exactly a small fry, Nick Bosa, jumps onto screen wearing a Make America Great Again hat, pointing at it, looking straight into the camera with this weird, menacing look. Like almost like if revanchism was a person, if reaction was a person, it would be all in Nick Bosa. Now, for what he did, he was fined $11,000, which to me would be a lot of money. To many of our listeners, would be a lot of money. To WPFW, that's a lot of money. If you're Nick Bosa, you make $34 million a year. Highest paid defensive player in the game, not a lot of money. Sure,
you've got $11,000 in between his couch pillows.
Oh my goodness, in between his toes.
That too.
Yeah, it'd be nice. I'm looking, you know, I'll look later between my toes, see if I got maybe, you know, $50. So he says all of this, and then he says, 11 grand, you know, that's nothing, worth it. I'd do it again 100 times, he says, which is easy for him to say, given his salary. Now, seeing Bosa, and then Bosa, of course, as you might imagine on social media, Chuck, as well as, you know, in the highest echelons of the Trump campaign, gets praised for this. You know, oh, what a profile in courage wearing a MAGA hat on TV for an $11,000 fine. And I'll bet you $1 million Nick Bosa is getting fit for Inauguration Day tuxedos as we speak. Gotta look good for that inauguration ball.
Oh, man. Well, whatever happened to shut up and dribble?
I know, right? It only goes one way. That only goes one way.
Yeah.
And, you know, the owners love what Bosa did. Therefore, it's like, we got to show we're sort of mad. Let's fine him $20. So now it's hard to look at Nick Bosa, the San Francisco 49er, wearing that iconic red and gold, without thinking of another political 49ers athlete. And obviously, if you're listening to this program, you know who I'm talking about. I'm talking about Colin Kaepernick. 2016, takes a knee, but he's not taking a knee for, I don't know, the total genocide of the Palestinian people. He's not taking a knee for massive tax cuts for the wealthy. He's not taking the knee for an anti-immigrant pogrom to take place in this country, the forcible deportation of over 10 million people. And I can't emphasize enough to our listeners to always think about the amount of violence that would take.
Can you pronounce pogrom again just one time?
Pogrom.
Okay. Thank you.
Believe me, that's important. That's
important.
That's a coming. And if he goes through with this in proper channels of resistance. But, you know, Kaepernick wasn't calling for harm to become. He wasn't calling for immunity for all police officers, which Trump is promoting. Actually, he was pushing the opposite, as you well know, racial equity, police violence. Now, when Kaepernick took his knee, and then, Chuck, I'll finally stop talking here, but I do think this is important. When Kaepernick took a knee, remember what happened? Remember, when Bosa wore his hat, he's embraced by the Republican Party. When Kaepernick took a knee, of course, the Republican Party immediately lost their minds. It was the 2016 election season. Trump basically said he should go back to Africa, and, you know, just the most racist dog whistle, like, if you don't like America so much, go back, you know, go somewhere else, you know. And that was Trump. And yet the Democratic Party had no home for Colin Kaepernick. There was no rush to defend him, because we are also a party against police violence and for racial equity. There was none of that. Instead, you had pretty uniformly either a criticism or much more likely a kind of mocking snark towards Colin Kaepernick. Like, oh, that guy's not what we're about. We don't take him seriously at all. The most poignant example of this for me, Chuck, was Ruth Bader Ginsburg, of all people. You know, right. The people that liberals just absolutely revere. You know, they've got candles with her picture on them, you know, yard signs in my neighborhood with her face on them. And she knocked Kaepernick as well for doing what he's doing, called it like silly and stupid and the like. Now, I raise all this, Chuck, because, of course, the Democrats lose in 2016, and they lose even though there is a mass movement taking place for racial justice. Now, why do they lose in 2016? Well, one reason, I would argue, is because they didn't embrace the movement. So they look like same old, same old. Same old politicians, same old doublespeak. Oh, you bring out one of the mothers of the movement, quote unquote, to speak at the Democratic convention. None of this is backed up. See, none of this is backed up by real change. Bernie is trying to talk about it. He's buried by the Democratic establishment. I raise all this with you, Chuck, just to say that this tells me a story about the 2024 elections. Because you have one area where the energy, the far right, all of that stuff is embraced by Trumpism as one of its engines. It doesn't have to be truthful. It doesn't have to be legitimate. It can be as hateful as it wants to be. But it is embraced. for people like Colin Kaepernick and the millions of people who he influenced, where's their political home? Why are they being consciously rejected by one of the two parties that actually have a chance of winning an election in this country? And if you can answer the question, why didn't the Democrats embrace Colin Kaepernick? You can also answer the question about why they lost in 2024. And with that, I will finally stop talking.
Well, I appreciate you talking. I do. Why? Well, now this is three elections in a row that the Democrats ignored the people. I don't know if you could do that for 12 straight years and alienate your base. Now, we know in sports and we know in advertising, the most coveted group is your 18 to 25 range.
There you go.
That if you lock that 18 to 25 range in, let's say you're a viewer for a TV show. If you could lock them in, you could lock them in for life. You're not getting someone to vote for you. You're getting someone to vote for you next 50 years. And the Democrats are the only group that sees their 18 to 25 base, say, let's do the opposite. Let's try to meet that 70-year-old where they're at. So when Bernie has a movement that's driven on health care, that had the wings of Occupy Wall Street under him, which helped bring him to a larger stature, and Medicare for All, which once polled at 24%, is now polling around 60 and 70% and pulling in 25% of Republicans because Republican families and grandmothers and mothers die too from bad health care. And they squash him. And they squash him again. I'm not going to get in details. And then now you have an incredible Free Palestine movement in the streets that I don't think people to this day recognize how deep it was. They don't recognize, because unlike the George Floyd movement, which at least got the cameras of the mainstream media. I was out there all the time. I believe it might be the greatest, biggest movement in that I could actually think of, certainly longer and more vast than even George Floyd. And we say George Floyd is the biggest racial justice movement in history as far as quantity in 1 year. And that was really a few months. But people don't know. In D.C. alone, there were like 3-4 protests a week. There were encampments outside of Blinken, encampments outside of the Israeli embassy, encampments at George Washington University with solidarity from all 9 universities. And that's just one city. It's all around the country and the world. And you have this young energy. No, we know better. I don't think you could do that for 12 years and not make yourselves extinct, because that's
exactly
what I think is happening.
And the thing with Gaza, though, that makes it so incendiary and why the crackdown by Democratic mayors, let's not forget, in many, many cases, the reason why, including this city, crackdown was so overwhelmingly intense against people who ostensibly should be in your coalition, largely young people of color, left-wing Jews, Jewish college students. That should be, I'm not saying of the Democrats, Chuck, I'm saying that should be the coalition of one of the two major political parties in a functional democracy. That's what I'm saying.
So right.
Let's just forget the word Democrats. And the candidate should be consciously representing those aspirations of the young. And I think and this is what people, I think, really miss in their analysis of this. Of course, that's the one issue, Gaza, that cannot be co-opted. Because we know that sections of, name the issue, Chuck, Black Lives Matter, LGBTQ, women's rights, abortion. There are leaders in these movements who, when it's time to elect Democrats, will demobilize struggle and become a part of the electoral machine because they've decided that having an ear at the table is more important than building mass politics. Now, this past year, it was particularly perverse, because I can't remember one time Kamala Harris spoke about racial justice or the Black Lives Matter movement. And so particularly perverse to be like, well, these are the folks we want to be around and get an ear, that should be a strategic imperative. But Gaza can't be co-opted. We saw that because their commitment to Israel, the Democratic Party, is so absolute and so unchanging that it doesn't change. And so of course the Democrats, they're like, well, we got to find votes. there was a logic in trying to go after soft Republicans. There was a logic in doing a speaking tour with Liz Cheney. Unfortunately, their logic was completely wrong. And the thing that I think they missed, Chuck, in a big way, is that for people of a certain age, like say between 30 and 50, like take that demographic, we're the people who were in the streets against the Iraq War. We're the people who voted for Barack Obama precisely because he wasn't Dick Cheney. You know what I'm saying? Like that Cheney name reminds us of things like New Orleans and Katrina and the hundreds of thousands of dead Iraqi families.
Well, he's the most hated man.
13% approval when he left office. 13%.
There it is. He was the most hated man before Trump. And he, you know, this was clear. It would be unthinkable to stand next to Cheney. Now, I do want to take one step because I want. Well, finish your thought, sir.
Oh, the one thing, and then this is just the end of the thought, and then I'll throw it back to you. Is the Democrats also made the big mistake of thinking that Jill Stein was going to be the alternative, and so they spend a ton of time then attacking the left, not just Jill Stein, but the left, and. Yeah. They didn't realize the number one opponent to them was not Jill Stein. It was the couch. It was people staying home because they're like, this is just politics as usual. Because when you see a Democrat going around with the Cheneys, when you see a Democrat be like, oh, we feel your pain about Gaza, but we're not going to change anything. It just feels so inauthentic, such political doublespeak. Such nonsense and no grasp for actual change. And so, like Kianga Taylor said, Harris lost because of death of 1,000 cuts. Maybe people didn't say, yeah, I didn't vote for her because of Gaza, although they certainly did say that in Michigan. But maybe they didn't say that in every case. But if you're a young person and you're staying home, maybe, or you're leaving the voting booth, maybe you don't, where you didn't fill in the part for president, because there were a lot of split votes this election too. Maybe you don't say Gaza's the reason you voted why you voted, but maybe you do say, you know what, this is just more political nonsense. There's no change. There's no chance. Nobody's different. Trump is a fascist, but Kamala's offering what? Cop city in all 50 states? You know, Democratic Atlanta, Chuck. We've talked about cop city.
You know, I mean, I was fearful for that, but you're
tell
absolutely
me you weren't
right.
Thinking about Cossack.
Well, I could tell you
tell
what
me
I was.
Thinking about it.
I was thinking back. I'm going to tell you what I was thinking about. Then I want to go back to Trump for a second because there's so many layers.
That's my whole thing. Just to say, that's my whole spiel. That's my whole spiel.
Okay.
It is like death of 1,000 cuts, inauthenticity, talking about joy at a time where people are experiencing tremendous economic hardship in terms of housing. Especially in terms of homelessness, which is going to go up again this year, in terms of inflation, which went up again in October, because just because prices go down doesn't mean companies will lower them. So
yeah.
It's ridiculous. Just humble capitalism. Yay.
Capitalism.
So this is where and Harris offering no change, you know, former President Obama in speeches being like, what's wrong with you? You don't have it bad. You have it good. You know, don't be a sexist, is what he said to black men. You know, what kind of message is that when people are struggling? So I'll stop there. That's why Trump won everybody.
There's a lot. There's a lot.
Under 50 grand. Trump won everybody who makes under 50 grand.
Well, so there's a lot. And I want to get to it because, you know, I voted. No, it's fine. I did vote third party. I can't vote for anyone who's promoting genocide. And then it was so right wing. Her campaign was actually not just neutral, is antagonistic, you know? Mm-hmm. I'm going to invite 5 Republicans to the DNC, but we can't have a Palestinian, even if they're going to vote for me. Mm-hmm. And many of the comments, I'm not going to rehash, but there were some comments of repeating rape lies that we know are debunked. And I could go down a list, but I don't really want to do that. But I do want to take one step back. There are a lot of people that I know who voted for Kamala.
Absolutely.
And I'm not talking about the people who don't care about what's going on in Gaza, because there's definitely that group. We see them online and some really nasty things. And I don't mess with people who only care about 4% of the population and of the world population, that is, and 96% because they're born on a different patch of dirt don't matter or have a global white supremacy. So I'm not messing with them. But I do know for a fact there are people who really cared about Gaza, but, you know, Trump puts the fear of God on them and they're like, okay, let's, you know, I'm going to vote for Kamala. So I think there, and many of those people are depressed or upset and, you know, obviously, and particularly Black women. And I say that because if we, you started off talking about your son and how he's, and Trump is normalized. And we have to remind ourselves that every point in time, Trump is not normal. You know, he's still a new thing. Like no one before him could just say whatever he wants to say when he wants to say it, talk like he's at a sporting event, and have complete immunity, right? And then he's probably the most unqualified person to ascend to this position. I you could go over his non-resume, his bankruptcies. Staffers say he doesn't want to read a briefing. And so when you do that, I do want to just take a note on the there is a racist aspect. Put policy aside for a second. I feel weird saying that because when I see all the people attacking her from the right and they're saying DEI, 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 when your guy is the most unqualified person ever, I'm seeing racism, right? See, I don't like Kamala because she's spurring a genocide, but that's not their reason. Their reason is she's a Black woman. When I hear J.D. Vance say she's trash, I have a good inkling that J.D. Vance ain't gonna say that to Gavin Newsom if Gavin Newsom's out there, you know, running. So you see these demeaning things from unqualified people. J.D. Vance, what did he do, right? Yeah. The most unqualified, mediocre white men get up there, and all of a sudden she's the one who got to prove the resume. And people feel it, particularly, you know, Black women are going to feel that. And we can't forget there's something racist to that, okay? So yes, I just want to put that out there.
Yes, now, can I just throw,
Go ahead. Racist and sex. Go ahead.
I was only going to point out that I can agree with everything you just said. But then we also need to answer why it took a last second push just for Black women vote to get up to the Biden level.
No, I know what the why is. I know what the why is, and I'm gonna get to that. I just want to name that. I just want to name that because
isn't that crazy though? Just as an observation that the campaign didn't even build support in that constituency. But sorry, go ahead.
No, they didn't. Well, it's crazy, and it isn't if you know Biden's history, because Biden's whole entire political history, and she was using the Biden playbook, is to go to the right of the Republican. The way we got mass incarceration wasn't just Reagan. It was Biden went to the right of Reagan in the 80s when he was part of the co-judiciary with Strom Thurmond. And he said, the way I take the issue away, we go harder. And then when George Bush was in office, he said, we need to triple the budget of George Bush. He's being soft on crimes. And he called Black people thugs. And he just went nuts. Because here's the thing. And Kamala had the same approach. We're going to have a more lethal military. We're going to be harder on the undocumented than Trump. That type of running, which is like really 1990s, 1980s, comes out of Biden's playbook and Biden's advisors. Go to the right of the Republican, I'll be a harder Republican. And if you can't beat someone, and if you can't beat someone with rhetoric, and you can never beat any Republican on rhetoric, you're always going to lose, and you certainly can't beat Trump. You can't out-Trump Trump. Are you serious? If you try to do that, there's only one way you could prove your point, and it's what Biden did. By having a harder policy, a more punitive policy, by having, say, we're going to fund the police, like Biden said at the State of the Union, and then puts 100,000 cops on the street. And then, I don't know if people caught this because it was a little under the radar, in Police Appreciation Week in May, all the Democrats were saying is that the Republicans want to defund the police, and they did. They wanted to cut the cops program. I know people are shocked to hear this. It was actually the Republicans this year that wanted to cut a lot in law enforcement. And Biden said, no, hell no. We're the police party. So you got to put this in perspective. He was replaying what he did with mass incarceration years ago, and Kamala got the same playbook. And you know what? I want my Republican to be a Republican. What are you getting in return? And I know I'm filibustering now, but I got one last thing to say, is that when I was on the at Black Lives Matter Plaza on election night, what happened
what was tell us about it.
It was very interesting. I heard something I'd never seen in any election. because in the previous election, when Biden won, people were dancing sort of in the street, but they weren't dancing for Biden. They were dancing that Trump was out of office, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it could have been anybody. But they were dancing. And this time around, and the call back then 4 years ago was push Biden left, push Biden left, push Biden left. So that didn't happen. Biden goes the other way, commits a genocide, puts more cops on the street, and raises the ICE budget. So Kamala is carrying that too, to your point earlier. She's carrying all of Biden's baggage, and people are like, hey, push left, and now you're still going right? Nah, I'm done with this. I've seen this a lot. Now I'm on Black Lives Matter Plaza, and it's very interesting. You see here a disparaging chant for Trump, and the disparaging chant for Trump is going on for about 40 seconds. All right, and I'm interviewing somebody. Netfo, by the way, I was interviewing Netfo from, WPFW.
Yep.
And
shout
in the
Netfo.
Shout out Netfo. I'm going to put out a video about another video on him. But one big video, now you hear that same disparaging chant for Kamala. And I've never heard that before at any election. The crowd that's been fighting for Palestine for this year had disparaging chants for both, and they went home. I don't know if you've heard that before. No. And then I sat down. And I sat down and I started getting nervous. I actually thought Kamala was going to win. I was terrified of Trump. I was terrified of Kamala. People say, why would you be terrified of Kamala? And I'm sitting on Black Lives Matter Plaza where I was in November and December 4 years ago when like it felt like a million right-wingers had a reaction and came to town before January 6th. There was November, December, yeah. And then January. And what I want people to know about all the fears we have with Trump and governing, and they're legitimate. They're legitimate. Like, we got to fight this man, right? But if people don't think that there would be an incredible backlash, had Kamala won, they're not looking at the whole thing. They missed the Obama years when hate groups rose up high. I was getting nervous, like, even for myself, because, you know, I cover these things, and I'm like, uh-oh, they're going to come, I'm going to be in the belly of the beast. And you know what can happen? You know what happens when they came to town? All the white liberals on Twitter and elsewhere saying, stay home, don't fight them. And I had a friend, Sean, Black House News. He would say, what? Are you saying let them turn D.C. into a sundown town? Is that what you're saying? We don't fight back now? Because I know if someone comes into town, you have bigger numbers. That's what we did in Charlottesville. And then we did it the next year. They had 300. We had 3,000. The next year, we had 30,000 when they tried to have the Unite the Right, too. But now it's stay home. And that was what's happening. And those crowds were empowered. Not they were empowered. When Trump lost is what I mean. So you were a lot of the racism we were going to have to deal with either way. Some vigilante racism would have been ugly, and in many ways it would have been uglier because of the reactionary white movement had she won, because they would feel terrible that this black woman there and they would have something to say. I don't want people to think it would have been easy. Anyway, I filibustered now.
No,
okay?
It would have been horrible, and we got to go to break. But you just said it, Chuck. You explained the conundrum in very well. You showed the conundrum instead of said it, because what happened, you just described it, the demobilizing of struggle in 2020, like struggle becoming demobilized. Think about it. Stay at home. Don't confront the right. That's how struggle gets demobilized. So because we have a party that's certainly looking fascist, and we have another party that is certainly does not look anti-fascist, you don't get anything resembling a symmetrical political fight. You get instead one side pushing forward, the other side lying down. And, you know, frankly, it was so interesting, Chuck, and then we should go to break and talk about Amsterdam, because that's a really important issue. We'll explain what we mean by that in a second, but Chuck, to get to this point, you got to see that when you talk about joy in the context of so much pain, it's going to seem perverse to people. And what Trump did, you know, his disgusting racist way, was create a narrative for people to understand their pain. And what the Democrats did was say, you have no pain. That's whining. And the only pain you have is because of Trump's Supreme Court. You know, say that to someone who's getting emergency food or who's worried about homelessness, worried about your kids living in a tent city. People, no one's.
And then that tent city being taken down like they did in McPherson Square. I was there.
Exactly. A temporary, not even not just talk about the definition of precarious housing, but I digress. I think though what we both agree on this, Chuck, it's so important. We need mass movements back to represent our side, and we need to fight Trumpism while also building independent institutions and independent political power. Agreed?
What you said.
Excellent. All right, let's go to break right now. We'll be back right after this on The Collision. We got a station break, and we're going to talk to you about what just happened in Amsterdam and why this is front page sports, politics, and news throughout the world. We'll be back right after this.
Want the pie, why is why, till we fry, watch us all, stand in line, for a slice of the devil's pie, drugs and thugs, women, wine, three or four, at a time, watch them all, stand in line, for a slice of the devil's pie,
who am I, justify, all of you, in our eye, I myself, feel the high, of all the highest spies. Behind the jail or in the grave, I have to lay this bed I made. And if I die before I wake, I hope the Lord don't hesitate. Get to heaven, went through hell. Tell my babes all is well. And all them fools sold for sale, sitting next to Jezebel. Pain and scream in my head, on my head, on my bed. Let my heart, let me hear.
We are back here on The Collision, where sports and politics collide here at your home for Jazz and Justice, 89.3 FM WPFW. Magic Mike, what were we listening to? That had me moving. Of course it was. Oh my God. I used to listen to D'Angelo back when you were nothing but a gleam in your father's eye. My goodness, that might be the oldest thing I've ever said. Yo, Chuck, are you there, sir?
Yes, sir. I'm here.
All right. Let's remember D'Angelo back in the 90s?
Yeah, yes, I do.
Step. At least vocally. I'm sure if I was like, hey, let's go run some hills, he might have some trouble. But we'll see. Yeah. Chuck, we were talking November 7th in Amsterdam. Something happened, which has been a story throughout the world. Do you want to say what that was, or do you want me to give the narrative before we discuss it?
You're way better at giving the narrative because I miss a fact and you jump in and do that fact. So let's just skip that. Tell them what happened.
I think you're great at doing a narrative, but basically, the story was that a team from Israel called Maccabi, with legendarily abrasive fans, I'll use the word abrasive, soccer hooliganism, people know what that is. They had a game in Amsterdam to play Ajax, which is the most prominent, famous soccer team in all the Dutch land. And the official word before this big game was that on November 7th, night of the game, Muslim teenagers who live in Amsterdam, largely Moroccan, I don't know how they know that, but that's what the news said, Moroccan teenagers of Muslim descent, trust me, I don't know how they know their religion, started moped biking through Maccabi fans, beating people. And my goodness, the international press we're outraged. You know, this looks like, you know, Germany in the late 1930s. This looks like Kristallnacht, systematic beating of Jews just for supporting a soccer team. But that's not the story of what happened at all. And it's just yet another example of anti-Semitism, which is very real, very real.
And you want some real headlines? Can I interject real headlines, DZ?
Yes, please. Please do.
Violent attacks in Amsterdam tied to anti-Semitism. Scooter youth, not soccer fans, hunt Jews in Amsterdam. Israeli soccer fans suffer anti-Semitic attacks in violent Amsterdam incident. Amsterdam bans protests after anti-Semitic squads attack Israeli soccer fans. Israeli soccer fans targeted anti-Semitic attacks over and over. You see anti-Semitic in every single one. Those were the headlines.
Right,
and
yeah,
Joe Biden. I'm going with Joe Biden.
Joe Biden.
Okay, Joe Biden tweets. Sorry, the anti-Semitic attacks on Israeli soccer fans in Amsterdam are despicable and echo dark moments in history when Jews were persecuted. We must relentlessly fight anti-Semitism wherever it emerges. DZ, if do you know if Biden has said anything since understanding the real story? And you talk about Islamophobia. I'll give it back to you.
No, he has not. And somehow he finds it time to thunder on social media, a social media platform, by the way, owned by Elon Musk, Trump supporter. So he actually aids the value of Elon Musk's online platform every time he bestows it with the words of the president of the United States. It's just ridiculous. It's such a joke. It's like, oh, we're facing fascism. You know, we might be. But to say all that, and then to just say, oh, by the way, what happened in Amsterdam is a horror. It reminds us of the 1930s. And hey, welcome Donald Trump. You know what I'm saying? Like they're doing this happy, happy, joy, joy thing after calling him a fascist. So, I mean, that's why people, I got to tell you, Chuck, why do I raise that? It's because that's why people, particularly young people, don't take politics seriously. Because it's like, wait, he's a fascist? What do we do? Oh, he's not a fascist. Now we're shaking his hand. You know what I'm saying? Like, it feels like political doublespeak. And the danger of it is that when you have an actual fascist, everybody thinks you're just like the boy who cried wolf.
Right. We were told.
I was going to say the liberal.
We were told he's Hitler for 4 years by Chuck Schumer, by Joe Biden, everyone. And then they're all shaking his hand and wishing him well and congratulations.
Like, that doesn't confuse people or make people think, ah, it's all BS. None of it really matters. But Chuck, the reality of what happened in Amsterdam is so different than those headlines. And
talk about it.
The problem is that once you tell a lie, it takes so long to spin it back to the truth. You feel me?
I do. Tell them the truth. What happened, DZ?
The truth is that a demonstration had been called against the presence of the Maccabi team in Amsterdam, part of the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement, and the red card Israeli apartheid that protests when they do, and they do this often, what they call sports diplomacy, when they send their teams throughout Europe. Notice they don't send them throughout Asia, but when they send them throughout Europe to play. So it's red card, and the United States for that matter, but although much more rarely, but it's red card Israeli apartheid. There was going to be a big demonstration. And hearing about the demonstration in long in advance, Israel sent, and this is very known, like members of the Mossad, you know, members of the military advance team, and then come the Maccabee supporters all week, abusing people physically, verbally, chanting about dead Palestinian children, like happily, talking about, like, I mean, if you read these chants, they'll make you just scream in anger, like boasting, like, hey, there's no children in the school anymore. Hey, there's no school anymore.
Yeah.
You know, like
sadistic
joking
stuff.
About that. Yeah.
Right.
Sadistic genocide stuff.
Yeah.
And
what if they said death to Jews, DZ? What if they said death to Jews? You think we'd hear about it?
They certainly said death to Arabs. They certainly did.
They said death to Arabs.
And what they
it rings different.
There's a great analysis of how the media has covered this on Mondo Weiss, because it shows how in the same headline you could have the word slur to describe free Palestine, like protesters were shouting free Palestine, and then say rough responses, like things like that, by the Maccabee fans. So everything is reactive. And nothing is worse than saying free Palestine. You could talk about the death of children. You could talk about, yeah, you're getting bombed, death to all of you. Ha, ha, ha. Isn't it so funny? And that's somehow just almost like boys being boys. And because keep in mind, everything we're talking about, Chuck, we have to acknowledge has an extremely male energy. The Maccabee fans, the Mossad, you know, this is all macho genocidaire attitudes, and really gross, like the most toxic kind of energy. And yeah, there was a response, and it was a two-sided response, and somehow it becomes Kristallnacht. And it's just one more example, Chuck, of, first of all, the trivialization of the Holocaust of the 1930s, which is someone whose family was affected by it, drives me absolutely bonkers every time they do that. And then, of course, it also speaks to the weaponization of anti-Semitism today. And we've seen this on the college campuses, of course, and the way it is used to persecute. And basically to say state power, no matter how harsh, by all means necessary, and we're going to see this under the Trump years, guarantee it, is somehow justified if it means combating anti-Semitism. Even if I, as Donald Trump, just nominated a Christian Zionist anti-Semite to be the ambassador to Israel, Mike Huckabee. So
right.
So there it is. And I, by the way, I loved, from a gallows humor perspective, the fact that he's nominating Huckabee to be ambassador to Israel. Not even a Jewish ambassador. Like bring in a Christian Zionist who thinks all Jews are going to hell. Let's put him in charge.
I don't think we give enough attention to Christian Zionists. There are more Christian Zionists than there are Jews. Jewish Zionists than Jews. And they're in the shadows. We give AIPAC all the attention. AIPAC really goes out of its way to get it with their posts, and they brag about stuff. But those Christian Zionists, they're something else.
They are something else, and they're very organized, and they're a very critical part of not just the Trump coalition, but of Benjamin Netanyahu and Israel's idea of how to get support in the United States, because they've largely given up on building mass Jewish support in the United States. You know, so they are looking for new constituencies, because the Jewish community is split. So they're running into the arms of Christian Zionists for no other reason. There's no commonality for them to do so other than the preservation of Zion by all means necessary. Who cares if one side wants it as a home for the Jews in a world gripped by anti-Semitism, as they argue, and the other side wants it because it's important for the rapture before all the Jews go to hell? You know, what's a little quibble?
What's a little quibble? And you know what? How many people could unite the whole Democratic Party with John Hagee from the white supremacists with Christians United for Israel on the same stage in a hate rally in Washington, D.C. last November?
I wrote about that.
Incredible. I know you wrote about it.
I went to that and wrote about it. And Chuck Schumer tore down the article in the well of the Senate. He was so mad. Whatever.
Oh, man.
But let me, I got to read you something just so people go, because I just said something that people might be a little bit surprised about when I said that Netanyahu doesn't have mass support among American Jews, and that's why he reaches out to these absolutely out of their minds Christian Zionists who are, let's be honest, basically white supremacists with a passport. That's Christian Zionists. Because, you know, they always do those trips to Israel. Okay. I'll work on that joke. There's something there. There is something there.
No, I liked it. I liked it. Not like laugh out loud liked it, but I cracked a smile.
That worked, right? White supremacists with a passport as a Christian Zionist.
Yeah, no, it worked for me. You know, it was good.
Yeah, there we go. Okay. So, all right. So check this out. J Street. A Jewish organization that has been split dramatically over this in terms of rank and file staffers. They want ceasefire now, embargo now. But then the leaders of J Street are like, no, support Israel, support Israel. So I was shocked that J Street even released these results. But they did a poll earlier this week, Chuck. I don't know if you saw it. Among the U.S. Jewish community, Jewish voters. Mm-hmm. Stop U.S. weapons to Israel. 62%. Resume funding for the UN, you know, because Israel said, oh, they've got, you know, Hamas soldiers inside the UN relief agency, and the US stopped funding it without any evidence, killing children by doing that. 66% want to resume funding. Sanction Israeli leaders, 66%. Increase aid to Palestinians, 72%. Establishment of a Palestinian state, 72%. Chuck, try to find 72% of people who agree on anything in this country. That's one thing. The second thing is, you know, that old expression for Jews is, you know, you get two Jews, you get three opinions. You know, like a lot of different opinions in this community, believe me.
Which we have demonstrated during the show, by the way.
Yes, we have. And, but check this out, though. It's like, there's, I think 72% like qualifies as a massive mandate.
Oh, yeah.
For the United pragmatic States win. To fight for a Palestinian state.
Yeah.
And that's why
Netanyahu is
reaching to the Christian Zionists.
You're absolutely right. But that also mirrors polls, not just use polls all the way across America. I mean, since really last November, wanting a ceasefire. And what I find most interesting about it is that for years, anytime I wanted something that was human rights based, people would, the pragmatists and the liberals and the Democratic Party would say, you know what? Yeah, that's too out of bounds. You're not being pragmatic. You can't get that done. Only 40% of people want it. And now comes an issue where human rights and popular opinion collide of your base. And you're still doing the same thing. So are you a pragmatist or not? If you're just a pragmatist, then you'd be with me. Even if you didn't care about human rights, you'd want Biden or Kamala to have a ceasefire, even if you didn't care about burning babies. But you can't even be a pragmatist now when the polls are in your favor. That's very telling.
Exactly. And you know, it's funny, even for a grizzled political vet like myself, I remember sort of like elbowing people last November in the movement and being like, do you really think, like a little elbow to the side, being like, hey, do you really think that the Democratic Party, because then it was Biden, do you really think the Democratic Party and Biden would sooner lose this election and support what Netanyahu, who hates them, is doing? Or do you think that they'll surely break from him at some point because he so clearly wants Trump to win? They're not going to be party to that, right? Right? And everybody was
wrong.
Like, yeah, it's hard to imagine they'd be that self-destructive. Gee. Wow.
That's what happened.
I think we just saw what happened.
We saw what happened. We saw the depth of that they were puppets. And both parties are puppets. There has never been a bigger masks off year than 23 and 24, really 2024. Everybody's mask came off, and you can't run, you can't hide, and you can't Shakespeare your way out of it. No wiggle room. Pick a side, the side of right, the side of history, the side of peace and human rights, or the side of genocide.
You know, I'm really glad you said that, Chuck. And let me just say one thing else real quick, because I want to be very clear about this. Anybody who we're listening to who voted for Kamala Harris because you were worried about Donald Trump, I get it 5,000,000%. And you've got my respect because I know the fear of thinking about this guy in office. You've got the show's respect. Your vote is your business. We understand that. I would never say that somebody was like, somebody with a good heart, I should say, Chuck, was like supporting genocide by voting for Harris, because maybe they felt like, I have to make this devil's bargain that it'll just be worse under Trump. So I not only have to hold my nose, but I have to wear a whole gas mask. Like anybody who
it's
did
it's lazy
that,
to
I
do
respect,
so.
I respect
I'm with
it.
You on this one.
I get it. I want to be like, yes. I get it. 5 trillion percent. And especially if people listening to us are in a state like Virginia or Pennsylvania, where it felt really fraught, like, wow, this vote really matters. Unlike Maryland, where it was practically ceremonial. So I think I say that, Chuck, because now that the election's over, we all got to come together. I don't care who you voted for. I don't care any of that stuff. You just said it, Chuck. This is about picking a side, right or wrong. And people are going to have to stand up and be counted. And that goes for people in the Democratic Party, too, which if things go like they should go, Chuck, the party should split and reform on a base, because they're losing their coalition, Chuck. Look at the votes in places like Chicago.
They're
losing
extinct.
Votes. New York.
I believe.
Votes. L.A.
Yeah.
Losing votes. Ugh. So they got
to. They tried to outright the Republicans. You can't do it. So I'm with you. I believe that. But I do believe there's a special something for on white people in general, because in this time, you know, we've talked about this, but in this time, when you have such a figure like Trump who rose to power off of his white racist pandering and his white supremacy at every turn. Well, you know what? That's white people's business, I believe, first and foremost, when you have a movement like that to shut that down, you know? If anybody else wants to join in, it's fine. But we got to deal with that. We got to deal with Trump. And then we got to deal with continuing to fight to stop this genocide. There's a lot on the plate. But and you know what? Yeah. I'm ready to fight.
I'm ready to fight, too. And just a little factoid is Trump's percentage of the white vote went down from 2016. And in sheer numbers, it's slightly down, but down. I mean,
really?
we got to start thinking politically how to build a new coalition with a different story about how to build a more just America. And I don't know. We got to figure it out, Chuck. I look forward to figuring it out with you, my man.
I look forward to figuring it out with you. Now, you got to understand something, though. Yeah, it might have gone down, but it's got nowhere to go but down the white vote. You know what I mean?
No, I agree.
You're like pulling 68%, right?
I agree. I just think we're dealing with a complicated entity. I agree.
Yeah.
It's just we're dealing with a more complicated entity than in 2016 when it was all bombast and BS. But I digress. Yo, Chuck, this is good. This is good. I love talking to you, man. We're going to talk more in the weeks ahead.
We will.
All right. For everybody out there listening, please stay frosty. We are out of here. Peace.
Never cop, no drop. Hold mics like ponytails tight and bobble ops. Stop, stick around. Come through and dig the sound on the flop round. 6060 cycle. Who throws hits around? Bound to go 3-plat. Came to destroy rap. It's an intricate plot of a B-boy strap. Ex-Smith cats get kidnapped. Then release a statement to the press. Let the rest know who did that. Metal fist terrorist. Claim responsibility. Broken household name usually set in hostility. What is MF, you silly? I like to take men's to the end for 2 milli. That's an audio daily double. Rappers need to fall off just to save me the trouble. Yo, watch your own back. Came in and go out alone, black. Stay in the zone, turn H2O to cognac. On doomsday, ever since the womb till I'm back where my brother went, that's what my tumor say. Right above my government, Dumoulin. Either unmarked or engraved, hey, who's to say? I wrote this one in BCDCO section. If you don't believe me, go get bagged and checked in. Cell number 17, I'm under the top bunk. I say this not to be mean, was bad luck, a pop junk. Pop the trunk on C-Cypher Punk, leave him left. Scrape, God forbid, if ain't no escape, blame MF tape. Definition super villain. A killer who loved children, one who is well skilled in destruction as well as building. While Sidney Sheldon teaches the trife to be trifer. I'm trading science fiction with my man, a live lifer. A pie. Pipe, a holler, a rhyme, a dollar and a dime. Do his thing, ring around the white collar crime. Get out my face, asking about my case. Need toothpaste, professor mint, monkey style, nigga, the death of dent. And dope fiends still in their teens. Shook to his turn witness. Real men's mind their own business. That's the difference between sissy beast and rappers is double dutch. How come I hold a microphone double clutch? COs make rounds, never have ox found. On shakedown, lockdown, L dreams of Fox Brown. On doomsday, ever since the wound till I'm back where my brother went. That's what my tumor say. Right above my government, Dumoulin. Either unmarked or engraved, hey, who's to say? Doomsday, ever since the womb till I'm back to the essence.
This is Dr. Ryan Daniels, president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century, with an announcement of a very important event, a national town hall meeting to assess the impact of the 2024 presidential election on the state of Black America and the Pan-African world. Progress or disaster? Thursday, November 14th, 6:30 p.m. sharp at the New York Avenue Presbyterian Church, 1313 New York Avenue Northwest in Washington, D.C. Speakers include Mark Morial, Dr. Julianne Malvo, Melanie Campbell, Reverend Siobhan Arlene Bradley, Hillary Shelton, Dr. George Frazier, Mel Foote, Maurice Mitchell, and Dr. Melina Abdullah. For further information, visit the website ibw21.org. That's ibw21.org.
On Election Day 1992, throngs of mostly Black voters gathered in Detroit City Hall to applaud the installation of the first Democrat in the White House in 12 years. When the applause died down, one black politician said presciently, "It really don't matter. The president could be Democrat or Republican, white or black. President could be Democrat or Republican, white or black. The Dow Jones can go up or down 500 points, and black folks still gonna be poor." Thursdays at